again, it's a pleasure to be here. We've been looking forward for some time being with you for this series. I've known the Sharps for about 100 years. My dad knew them before that, and have worked with Keith and others of the Sharps, and have a great deal of appreciation for them. That scroll has fallen a few times before, so it'll be fine. We want to talk to you this morning about archaeological evidence for the New Testament. I enjoy preaching the gospel, but as Jude said, sometimes you don't get to do what you want to do. You'd like to talk about things that thrill our hearts, the redemption of Christ. But when we're attacked, when enemies deny, it's our job to defend. And Christianity is unique among all the religions of the world in that it is founded on fact that can be defended and must be. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, Peter says, "Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you, to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." The word translated defense in this passage, the word apologetia in the original, it refers to a speech like a defense attorney would make. You be ready to defend the truth of the Word of God to those who don't believe it. Now, we've grown up in an age where we really didn't have to do a whole lot of that. But that's not the case anymore. Our faith is being attacked on every hand, and it's our job to defend it. And so we need to roll up our sleeves and go to work and do that. Muslims, Hindus, Confucianism have no basis in evidence like Christianity has. There are no eyewitnesses that testify. There are no fulfilled prophecies that verify. You don't see archaeological evidence that confirm facts upon which the truths rest. But that is the case with the New Testament. Let's begin looking at one of the more dramatic examples of evidence that's found recently. To give an example of the kind of evidence that substantiates our faith in the New Testament. Tonight we'll be talking about the Old Testament. I've been more directly involved in some of that. But we'll look at the New Testament evidence this morning, and this is a bone box, an ossuary. This reflects the Jewish custom, burial practices, in the first century. Very short period of time, they used ossuaries to bury people. They would bury the first time, laying out the body on a stone bench, come back about a year later, collect the bones, and put them in a box like this. And from about the time of the birth of Christ to about 70 A.D. is the only time the Jews were ever doing that. And so if you find an ossuary, you know just pretty close to how old it is. This one was found with an amazing inscription on it that speaks of James, the brother of Jesus, the son of Joseph. Now that's pretty amazing. Obviously, it has been controversial, but I think the verification has been just absolutely unquestionable. Biblical Archaeology Review, which is a publication that allows every rank liberal, as well as a few conservatives every now and then, to write, says this is of breathtaking significance. The editor, Herschel Shank, says it's the most important find in the history of New Testament archaeology. If that's the case, it's a good place to begin. It's been very controversial because of the implications. James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. Well, it embarrasses the Catholics because Jesus is not supposed to have brothers. Mary was supposed to be a perpetual virgin. It certainly embarrasses the liberals who say that there never was such a real individual. And so there have been frantic efforts to try to refute this, and naive reporters report all kinds of wild ideas. But this is a diagram of the inscription, of course, read right to left. James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. This is unprecedented. You find these bone boxes sometimes with a name. Rarely you find the name, the son of, but in only two instances, this instance and one other, was the brother mentioned. The other instance, he was the brother of the high priest. A very obvious significance is implied there. Jesus had brothers. Well, that shakes up the Catholics, of course. John chapter 7 makes that very plain. The Catholics try to say, well, these were really cousins, not really brothers. But his brother said to him, leave, go to Judea, so that your disciples may see your works. And verse 5 says his brothers were not believing in him. They were disbelievers. That would include James initially. But we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that Jesus, after the resurrection, appeared particularly to James, his brother, the unbeliever. And that made a difference. And we see James very prominent in the New Testament church after that. In fact, if you make a case for the primacy of any apostle, I think it would be James rather than Peter. In Galatians chapter 1, the apostle Paul speaks of going to meet the apostles after his conversion. And he didn't see any of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother, specifically mentioned. In Galatians chapter 2, he refers to several, including James, who were pillars in the church. Barnabas gave the right hand of fellowship. In Acts chapter 12, we read of the instruction, report these things to James and the brethren. Peter has been released from prison. He was to be killed. They thought, they prayed, he was released. This is wonderful. Go tell James and the rest of the brethren. In Acts chapter 15, they had the conference there in Jerusalem where they were trying to sort out what they should accept from the Old Testament requirements and from the New. And finally, after they assembled the New Testament, those who were inspired in New Testament times, and they reached a consensus, James gave the conclusion. After they'd stopped speaking, James answered, saying, brethren, listen to me. And he summed it up for the church at that time. Very prominent individual, the brother of Jesus. We do have historical indication of what happened to him, reflected in this 13th century mosaic in Venice. He was eventually, we're told, thrown from the pinnacle of the temple. And that didn't kill him. He was then beaten with a fuller's rod and then buried in the vicinity, then reburied in the ossuary shortly after that. The earliest reference is from Hegesippus, 150 A.D. Now, that's not very far removed from when John laid down the pen of inspiration on the Isle of Patmos. Now, we don't have Hegesippus, but we do have Eusebius, who quoted from Hegesippus. And Eusebius was 316 A.D. He had the copy of Hegesippus at that time. So that's pretty good indication that this was the idea at the time of Hegesippus. He says that Hegesippus said, James was thrown from the pinnacle of the temple. When that did not kill him, he was stoned. When that did not kill him, his head was stove in by Fuller's club. History indicates, or the same reference indicates, that he was buried nearby the pinnacle of the temple. We're looking here at the Temple Mount, and this corner is the pinnacle. It was much more of a precipice before the Romans piled all the rubble around it. It was much further down to the bottom, but still a rather imposing precipice at this point. Looking from this diagram, you see the corner of the Temple Mount pointed to as the pinnacle of the temple. The community directly across the Kidron Valley is Silwan, and that's where there are a number of caves, and it's a Palestinian community now. We'd love to remove some of those houses and excavate there, and hopefully we can do that in the future, but you can see the caves and the burial places there. And it was in one of those that this ossuary was found. Looking at this scene, you see the Kidron Valley separating the Temple Mount, the pinnacle from Silwan, and it's about where that word Silwan is that this was found. So it's exactly what should have been. There has been a great deal of controversy about it. First, the Department of Antiquities affirmed that this was from the first century. Then they claimed the fellow who found it was a fraud, and they put him in jail and said it was a fraud. And why would the Jews say that? Well, it's almost like asking the Sanhedrin to verify the resurrection of Christ. What do you expect them to say? They've got to deny Jesus, the son of Joseph, the brother. This is verifying the New Testament description of Jesus. And so they have denied it, and they have been very, very embarrassed in this court proceeding, which is still ongoing. They had 15 witnesses initially who were to testify against the individual who had this artifact. I wish we had time to go into the whole story. It's revealing. One by one, they've dropped out. There are only two that are left. One is an expert in medieval history of England. I don't know what that has to do with this. The other is a geologist. He has no knowledge of ancient writing. 13 of the others have left, and there is a death blow that has just been struck to the prosecution that has not yet been revealed, will be in the next few weeks, but a photograph was found from the prosecution collection. The indictment says that this individual took a real ossuary that had an inscription on it, but added the brother of Jesus to it and the son of Joseph to it, and that was later, and did that in 2002. Well, they found a photograph from 1967 in the apartment of this individual that has been verified by the FBI as to date and to this, and the photograph shows the inscription. So it existed in 1967, long before the indictment. At that time, the owner had no idea that it was even important. He didn't even know what it said. It was in 2002 that an expert came in and saw it and said, this is significant, and brought it to light. And so I think it has been absolutely verified. They're not questioning the fact this was from the first century and that it does, that some of the writing is real. They've tried to say part of it isn't. Actually, the owner's mother cleaned part of it with something like cleanser, which was a mistake. But then that can be determined, and that did justify some of the objections. But it has been verified, and I think absolutely verified, and the case is falling apart against this fellow. The Wall Street Journal, not a conservative publication, says the James Ossuary is what it seems. It is the earliest recorded reference to Jesus of Nazareth. I think they're absolutely right. Even the Dallas Morning News has acknowledged, well, yes, this is pretty good evidence, but it's the only archaeological evidence supporting faith in the New Testament. I guess it's the only thing this reporter knew about, and he went to school where they told him there wasn't any evidence. But is there anything else? Well, there's just mountains of evidence. To begin with, there's another ossuary that I think is very significant that was found in 1990. And that's the ossuary of Caiaphas. On the outskirts of Jerusalem, you can see the Temple Mount there toward the center, Mount of Olives there on the horizon with the tower. They were building a new road and found a burial plot. This shows the map of where it was found. And these burial plots contain ossuaries from the first century. It was a very important, prominent family. There were a number of ossuaries found. One of them, one of the most beautiful that had been found, ornate, obviously an important person, and on the end of it, we have the name of Caiaphas. a beautiful ossuary. Inside were the bones of about a 60-year-old man, so a very prominent family. The high priest, mentioned, of course, by three of the Gospels and in the book of Acts. Matthew describes Caiaphas interviewing Christ and turning him over to Pilate. I think we found his bones and his ossuary. And even the liberals have not really objected to this. They haven't. All of them haven't affirmed it. A few of them have. But there have been no answers to this contention. All of us, of course, know the story of Pilate. And do we know of such an individual who washed his hands of the guilt, he thought? Recorded in Matthew 27, Pilate saw that he had accomplished nothing, but rather that a riot was starting. He took water, washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, "I'm innocent of this man's blood." Well, we had known of Pilate from some historical references, but not from archaeology. He was attested by Josephus, who mentioned him, by Philo, first century Jewish philosopher, and also by Tacitus, which is pretty good documentation. But then in 1961 at Caesarea Maritime, this stone was found, which is actually reused. It was in a temple, then torn down, used to build some steps in another place. But it referred to the Emperor Tiberius, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. He built this to honor the Emperor Tiberius. But Pontius Pilate is specifically mentioned in this documentation. More obvious evidence of what we read about in the New Testament in stone. In Matthew chapter 2, we read of Herod the king, often referred to as Herod the Great. He was the baby killer. Matthew 2, verse 10, Herod saw that he was tricked by the wise men. He was infuriated, sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, according to the time he had learned from the wise men. Well, this is just a ridiculous story. Who in the world could be that cruel, killing all of the children? Well, here is a man who certainly fits that description, and we have all kinds. The most obvious is the temple itself, which was built by Herod. The restored temple was much smaller, thought to look something like this. The Hasmonean palace was added to it, and then an extension in the times between the Testaments. But then Herod just greatly elaborated on this. He was a megalomaniac who wanted to be greater than Solomon, and greatly enlarged, rebuilt the temple, and this was the temple of Jesus' time. It looked something like this, and I think this is an excellent depiction of what existed at the time of Christ. It was monumental. This was built by King Herod. Looking at the colonnade that you see on the end, it's been restored, artist rendering to look something like this, and I think that's an accurate rendition. But this is just a part of what Herod did. We go to Caesarea Maritime, and an artist reconstruction indicates that it looks like this, and there's good evidence for this. It looks, of course, quite different today. We were there just a few weeks ago. Magnificent structures. This is the end of about a 30-mile aqueduct, which was an incredible structure that brought water from the mountains down to this area. Many have heard of Masada, which was a fortress overlooking the Dead Sea. This was built by Herod. One of his most monumental accomplishments was Herodium. This was an artificial mountain, almost like the pyramids, but much larger. The scale is very difficult to perceive from this perception. But this was a mountain that was built to honor him, and he was buried here, though it wasn't until recently the tomb was found. Josephus describes the marble stairs leading to the tomb. 200 steps of purest white marble led up to it. It was crowned with circular towers. Its courtyard contained splendid structures. Looking at the top as it appears today, you can see where the circular towers were. artist to restore it to look something like this. It's still very impressive when you go up there today and you see this was built by this fictitious fellow that never existed, that the Bible talks about, King Herod. Down at the base, you see a huge swimming pool and colonnades. This is where he could be Roman. In Jerusalem, he had to be Jewish, but he could be Roman out here at Herodium. Looking from about two-thirds of the way up with my wife in the foreground, you see that swimming pool. This is where he drowned his mother and his four sons. This was not a nice fellow. He was afraid that no one would cry when he died. Can you imagine? And so he ordered that upon his death, 200 of the leading aristocracy of the Jews would be killed, so that someone would die. Someone would cry when he died. And there were tears, but they weren't for him. Just a few months ago, May of this year, his tomb was finally found. A friend of mine, Ehud Netzer, had been searching there for a long time, and here about two-thirds of the way up the hill, behind a Byzantine building, which was actually hiding it, it was discovered, along with those stairs that Josephus described leading up to it. This is a picture of the dig where we were just a few weeks ago. The sarcophagus where his body was laid was found. It was beaten to pieces for some strange reason. This was a real person, and we know that, and we can prove that. But the ossuary is the only archaeological evidence there is. It's crazy. In Acts chapter 12, we read of another Herod. He was the one, this was the grandson in royal apparel. He's giving an address, and he's claiming to be God. They kept crying out, the voice of God and man. Josephus says he had a sparkling robe, and the sun rays just sparkled off of it. And God was obviously offended and struck him with worms. Verse 23 says he was eaten by worms and died. We know from historical documentation what he did, but here's a picture of him. If you'd like to see him, kind of looks like something's eating him. But this was Herod Agrippa the First. Then King Agrippa, Herod Agrippa the Second, as he's sometimes referred to, is mentioned in Acts chapter 25. He's the one before whom Paul gave his defense. There have been a number of coins with reference to King Herod on it. Here is the term, King Agrippa, on the coin. And this not too well preserved coin shows his likeness on the face. This is a real person. We have archaeological evidence of that. In Matthew 22, we read of the reference where Jesus holds the coin when he was asked about paying tribute to Caesar. And he said, whose image and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. Well, there was one coin at that time that had Caesar's image on it, the denarius. A number of those survive. I purchased one. My wife wears it as a pendant around her neck. This is the coin that Jesus held up. This is the emperor, Tiberius, that ruled at that time. This is not made up. It fits the historical evidence. In Acts chapter 13, Paul was on a journey preaching the gospel in Cyprus, and he comes to Paphos. They found the magician there, Bar-Jesus, and then the proconsul, Sergius Paulus, a man of intelligence, who summoned Barnabas and Saul and sought to hear the word. Well, critics had said for years there was no office of proconsul. This was just made up, and certainly no Sergius Paulus. The idea that the ruler would become a Christian is just made up. Verse 12 says the proconsul believed when he saw what happened, was amazed at the teaching of the Lord. Well, in 1961, the inscription was found there just outside Paphos that mentioned specifically Sergius Paulus and his title, both the title that they had questioned as well as the individual. Then, about 10 years ago, just outside of Rome, another stone, very similar, was found, also mentioning Sergius Paulus and giving another title. Evidently, he was stationed there in Rome, in Cyprus, and then returned to Rome and served there, this time as a Christian, and still with distinction, so that his name was mentioned on the inscription. Mentioning that area, let's look in Romans chapter 6, and we find reference to an individual at Corinth. Gaius, host to me, and the whole church greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, greets you. Well, here's a prominent individual who is a member of the church at Corinth. Would it be possible to find reference to him? Well, yes. Here among the ruins at Corinth, we see Erastus' name mentioned in return for the idolship. This is the title of treasurer. He laid this stone at his own expense. And so there it is in stone, the individual mentioned there in Romans. But of course, the only evidence you have is this ossuary. You see how silly that statement is? Look with me at Acts chapter 18. Gallio, again, proconsul of Achaia, this is the area that included Corinth, rose with one accord against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat. So Gallio was the judge, and it was his judgment seat before whom Paul was brought. At about 51 A.D., is there record of that? Well, the term judgment seat was well known at this time, and this is a judgment seat there at Corinth, where Paul would have been brought before him, and it's readily acknowledged even by the secular archaeologist. Here is the term translated judgment seat. It's a play on words in the original, but it's a term that describes where Paul was brought. Of course, in Acts chapter 18 that we referred to, Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the judgment seat. This very likely was the spot. But do we know that Gallio was proconsul then at that time? We see the judgment seat. Okay. But then about 15 years ago, this inscription was found. It is now at Delphi in Greece. It was there at Corinth. But this is by the Emperor Claudius Caesar, who ruled from 41 to 54. That would include and fit with the idea that Paul was before his judgment seat in 51. And the emperor is writing a letter to Gallio, my friend and proconsul. Wow. You just couldn't make it up any better. Actual documentation of exactly what we read in Acts 18. Of course, we know in Romans chapter 14, we're told that all of us will stand before the judgment seat of God. This is that same term, as Paul stood before the judgment seat of Gallio, the friend of Caesar. In Acts chapter 19, we read that Paul and those with him went to Ephesus. They recognized he was a Jew. A single outcry arose from all of them. He was, of course, undermining their business. They made silver statues, idols of Diana or Artemis. And he was saying these idols are nothing. They're not real. And they had a fit and a riot. And they were in the theater crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Well, you go to Ephesus today and you see this was obviously a notable city. The ruins are very impressive. This is the library. The front of it there in Ephesus. This is not too impressive a spot, but it's the spot of the Temple of Diana. Not all that impressive today. No doubt people would look at it and say, "Wow, Diana must be real. Look at the temple." Well, just wait a few years. It's a swamp. They did stack up some of the ruins so that you could tell this is a column. This is a picture of Diana. The obsessment with the female breast is not peculiar to our age. But this was the goddess of fertility. Verse 29 says, the city was filled with confusion. They rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. So they dragged them to the theater. Well, here's a picture of the theater. Here's the road that leads to the theater along which they were dragged. You probably can't still see the heel marks, but this is where they were dragged to the theater, where the crowd was crying out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Again, obvious archaeological evidence that fits exactly what we read in the New Testament. Now, let's go back in time to the early part of the New Testament story in Luke chapter 8, where the decree went out from Augustus, Caesar Augustus, that a census be taken of all the inhabitants of the earth. There's been a good deal of controversy about this, but I think we have incredible documentation. We know Caesar Augustus. A number of busts tell us exactly what he looked like. This passage says that the census was actually undertaken under his authority by Quirinius, who was governor of Syria. That's a term that included at least the upper part of Palestine at this time. Quirinius was the governor. Well, who was Quirinius? Do you have any reference to him? Well, at Antioch of Pisidia, this inscription was found and refers specifically to Quirinius. So we know there was a Quirinius who was a public official, and that was from this period, from about 4 to 11 A.D. is when this is dated. But an incredible discovery was made recently, and I am scheduled to be in Venice later this year to get a better picture of this tombstone, of an obscure Roman soldier who lived in Venice. Well, Roman soldiers were sent around the world, and this one was sent to what was Syria at that time, or Palestine, and his name was Secundus. Okay, well, here's Secundus, a Roman soldier from Venice who is sent to Palestine. He's in the service of the divine Augustus, the one who ordered the census. Okay. And then it says he is under Quirinius in Syria. So Quirinius, the governor in Syria under Augustus, these were his superiors. And it says he conducted a census by the order of Quirinius. He was one of the soldiers who conducted that census under Quirinius, who was under Augustus, all documented in one obscure tombstone in Venice. Just absolutely awesome. Making mockery of those scholars who would say there's no archaeological evidence. Exactly what we read in Luke 2 is documented. In Acts chapter 11, we find the church at Antioch being taught by Agabus, the prophet, who stood up. This happened, we're told, in the days of Claudius Caesar. This is one of the later Caesars. We know what he looked like. We have his bust. He was followed by Nero, who was the one who burned Rome and imprisoned, we're told, Paul and Peter, probably in this prison, which we see in Rome. I have a friend who did his dissertation on this prison, and there is excellent documentation that this was the spot where both Peter and Paul were imprisoned, the Mamertine prison there in Rome. This is a woodcut from about 225 A.D. that pictures Peter before an altar. There were some Roman church influences even at this early time. An angel is providing in this picture, confronting the soldier and providing him with water. And we notice in the background, actually it's a cover for a stairway. You can see the bottom stair at the base of that screen in the background. This is the way it looks today. You see that bottom step? We back that up and compare it with the woodcut That shows both the altar and the bottom of the stairway. This is the way that it's hard to get a lens wide enough to capture all of this. That altar is still there, here with the cross upside down, which reminds us that tradition tells us Peter was crucified upside down because he would not allow himself to be crucified as the Lord was. Paul was also here, and we have excellent documentation of that. Clement of Rome in A.D. 95, written about the time, I think, as the book of Revelation was written, testified that Paul was beheaded outside of Rome at the third milestone on the road to Ostia. Reading from his writings, weeping friends took his corpse and carried it for burial to the subterranean labyrinths, referring to the catacombs, where through the ages of oppression, the persecution of the church found refuge for the living and sepulchers for the dead. We know when and where Paul was buried, but he was there in that prison, I believe. Nero put him there. He was followed by Vespasian. He was the one who ordered the destruction of Jerusalem by his son Titus, a brute of a fellow, at least as appeared here. The Romans destroyed Jerusalem. Well, you go all the way back to Deuteronomy. Moses said this would happen if you don't obey. Remember the cursings and the blessings were read. We'll talk more about that this evening. Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. Moses said when he talked about what would happen if they don't obey, the Lord will bring a nation to you from afar. This won't be Babylon. This won't be Assyria. This won't be Egypt. A nation from afar, from the end of the earth, will come as an eagle swoops down. We know the eagle was the symbol emblazoned on the chest and on the banners of the Roman soldiers. Jesus himself in Matthew 24 referred to the temple buildings and said, "Do you not see all this? Truly I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that will not be torn down." These beautiful, impressive buildings that Herod built are coming down. In verse 28 of that chapter, he says, "Wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together." And then in verse 15, he says, "You'll see the abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel the prophet." What did Daniel say? That fourth world empire, the Roman Empire, in the days of those kings, this is going to happen. Jesus said it's what Daniel the prophet talked about, where the eagles swoop down, a nation from afar. All of this was foreseen by Moses and by Jesus, and we know that's exactly what happened in 70 AD as the Romans marched on Jerusalem and burned it and destroyed it and carried out the articles from the temple and marched into Rome with them. Here is the Arch of Titus with the Colosseum in the background. The Arch of Titus commemorates that destruction in Jerusalem. It stands today as a monument to what both Moses and Jesus talked about. Looking under that arch, at this point, you see the depiction of the carrying away of the articles from the temple, the menorah. There's an artist drawing of it, but still clearly seen in the Arch of Titus for all to see today. This is what Moses said was going to happen. This is what Jesus said was going to happen. This is exactly what happened. And yet the Dallas Morning News says this ossuary is the only thing there is. In addition, we have the Caiaphas ossuary that's even acknowledged by the enemies. We have the monument naming Pontius Pilate, found at Caesarea Maritime. Many monuments by Herod the Great. The bust of Herod Agrippa I, the coin identifying the second, the image of Caesar on the tribute penny, the monument naming Sergius Paulus there at Paphos, Cyprus, the proconsul, the pavement naming Erastus at Corinth, the treasurer of the city, and then the theater there at Ephesus, and the images of Diana, the statue of Caesar Augustus, and the inscriptions naming Quirinius, the governor of Syria who conducted the census, statues and monuments for Claudius Caesar, Nero, Vespasian, and the Arch of Titus. And this is the tip of the iceberg. There is a mountain of evidence. And when you hear people saying things like this, and they will, you need to know that there is a technical term for that. It's a lie. It's not so. There is a mountain of evidence verifying exactly what we read in the New Testament. We need to be ready to make a defense. And we certainly can. And there is tremendous evidence that verifies our confidence in exactly what the Word of God says. If you're here this morning and haven't rendered obedience to the instructions of the New Testament, you're without excuse. This is the truth. It is the Word of God, and you will face it before the judgment seat of the Almighty. You can't escape that. What will you say? There'll be no excuse. You need to come this morning confessing your faith in Christ, repenting of your sins, and being baptized into Christ, just as that divine book it describes and instructs. If you've wandered away, come back. Make those things right while we stand together and sing.